Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to, do we have committee bills?
Yes, we do.
Could you give a list to...
Yes, sir.
I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing legislative concepts as bills. Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee accept as committee bills the following LCs: 1856, 1959, 2395, 2656, 2657, 2759, 2762, 3072, 3324, 3325, and 3337.
Thank you, Representative. Representative, we're introducing some legislative concepts. Representative Barton moves we accept legislative concepts 1856, 1959, 2395, 2656, 2657, 2759, 2762, 3072, 3324, 3325, and 3337 as committee bills. Is there a discussion?
I'm worried these could result in an uncompensated overtime. I just want to put that.
Yeah. Well, we know a little bit about something about that.
It's a topic we've been discussing.
Representative, we're introducing legislative concepts. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. I'm going to close the work session as well. And I'm going to open a... But just for the record, no opposition commits you to no votes on any of those concepts. Does not commit you to any votes or support or lack thereof of concepts. I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 2624.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2624 defines economically distressed worker training and eligible economically distressed workers for purposes of unemployment insurance benefits. The measure directs the Employment Department to adopt rules for administering the state's dislocated worker program and to consult with the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development on rulemaking to ensure that all programs for eligible workers provide integrated and appropriate training and education. There is no revenue impact on the measure, and we are waiting for the fiscal analysis. Representative Witt, actually.
Oh, Representative Witt, thank you very much. Representative, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Brad Witt, a state representative from House District 31, here today in support of House Bill 2624. Quite simply, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is a bill that attempts to extend unemployment benefits to temporary and part-time employees. You will note that in the bill, it also describes folks who would be in approved training programs, and while that's that would be something that I certainly would advocate for, it's also part of a federal requirement at this point. So that part of the legislation is probably redundant. Our economy has changed significantly since unemployment insurance was first brought into effect back during the Great Depression in the 1930s. Back then, typically, if someone was fortunate enough to have a job, they were looking as near as possible to full-time employment. That's no longer the case in today's economy, and in many instances, folks, particularly in the retail sector, which I am familiar with, it is oftentimes the rule rather than the exception that folks have at least two jobs, and in many instances, three. Oftentimes, these folks are locked into part-time employment, and were they to lose one job, depending on how many they have, they're looking at a reduction in their family income of one-third to 50%. Mr. Chairman, that is a horrendous hit to any family's budget. And given the economic crisis that our nation and our state faces today, it is in large part due to a general decline in demand throughout our economy. Quite simply, the consumer is absent without leave. And unless and until we provide an opportunity for folks to have sufficient income to be able to spend in this economy, then we are going to continue in the demand crisis that we currently face. This bill provides a modicum of support on a part-time basis at part-time levels for folks who lose part-time jobs. It is also, I think, one of the best stimulus bills that will come before this legislature this session. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try and answer broad questions. The details are ones that I would hope folks would refer to the Employment Department. Thank you for this opportunity. No,
thank you, Representative. And we're going to get to the department after some nice people testify and talk about the, you know, the fiscal side of it, any other states that do it, you know, any kind of flexibility. But I just want to thank you for bringing this, because all through college I had two or three part-time jobs. There's families out there that depend on this, and you're exactly right. This money goes right straight back into the economy. So, anyway, any questions of our good colleague here? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I'm just going to go right down the line here. I have four people signed up. I'm going to call two. Joy Markheim, I hope I pronounced that right, and Joanne Truesdell, please. Whoever wants to go first.
Good morning. Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm president of Clackamas Community College, which is a Clackamas WorkSource partner and part of the integrated service delivery model for Workforce Investment Council of Clackamas County. And this morning, my charge is to support this bill wholeheartedly. I have a few pieces of information that our staff would like me to share with the committee. A couple of things about this bill is it is about access and increasing that access significantly to training and educational opportunities. As Representative Witt spoke earlier, our economy in our area has changed, and we are facing a number of people who have been not necessarily downsized out the door, but have been downsized in the number of hours they are working. And it significantly affects their perceptions and their realities around unemployment insurance. And this bill reduces that risk. Our opinion around professional technical education definition is that it's right on. We have significant numbers of one-year certificates that we provide. One is a utility training certificate that actually someone could get a great entry-level job working for our utilities in apprenticeable jobs. I'd like to share a quote from one of our WIA, our Workforce Investment Act First Line Supervisors. This would be a big step in the right direction. Currently, anyone that wants to go into training has to worry that they will be cut off from UI because they are, quote-unquote, unavailable to look for work at any time and accept any job. Anyone in a short-term workshop or a training that does not equal 12 credits is at risk of losing their UI benefits. Speaking from a workforce perspective, the current law governing TUI is a complete opposite of our current objectives of getting people retrained and reemployed quickly. Even a workshop taken at one of our training centers or at the unemployment department services could cause someone to lose their unemployment insurance. The result is that people either will not take the chance and attend those workshops, or they are deliberately, unfortunately, concerned that as they fill out their forms, they're falsifying information. Every week, we receive over 3,000 individuals who inquire around opportunities. In our district, we have around 18,000 individuals where this would be potentially of benefit. The total number of people who might go to school part-time is probably around half that many individuals, at about 9,000. As I've been around our campus for the last month and a half, as we've been discussing our own internal finance issues, I've been speaking with numbers of students. The average age on our campus is 28. The people who attend those meetings are individuals who have been laid off from temporary or part-time jobs. They have been moving slowly down the ability to be employed full-time, from full-time down to part-time, from part-time down to nothing. And the one item that they keep coming up with is, I need help. I have financial aid. The college has done well at that. I have other kinds of training dollars. Other places are doing well with that. I still cannot make ends meet. Is there anything that can be done to help me? This bill would provide that support. Thank you very much.
Kevin?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Good morning, Representative Schaffler, members of the committee. My name is Joy Markheim. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We're a nonprofit research and education institute located in Silverton, Oregon. We focus on budget, tax, and economic policies with an interest in improving decision-making and expanding opportunities for all Oregonians. I am here this morning to speak in support of HB 2624. Which would help low-wage workers access training opportunities in order to use a period of employment to upgrade their skills and open opportunities to move into higher-paying and perhaps more stable work. Every other year, OCPP puts out a report on Oregon's economy from the perspective of working people. And as we explain in our most recent such report, it's titled Rolling Up Our Sleeves, working families in Oregon faced a tough economic environment even before the onset of the current recession. During a seven-year period when Oregon saw strong growth, working families saw stagnant or shrunken wages. And economic insecurity has increased among working families, not simply because they've been excluded from the benefits of the prosperity they helped create, but also because the public systems that ought to help them when the market fails too often have not been available. HB 2624 is an example of how Oregon can start to help build an economy that works for working families by improving the structures that provide economic security. The training provisions in this bill would allow low-wage workers who are trying to enter or complete a job training program would help those people at the very bottom of the wage scale weather the recession and upgrade their skills. And investing in a better trained, skilled workforce will benefit the state's economy as a whole in the long run. And in addition, thanks to the foresight of those who structured it, Oregon's trust fund, unemployment insurance trust fund, is financially sound. Unlike the trust funds of many other states which are facing insolvency, Oregon's trust fund has the capacity to absorb the cost of this program. I'd like to explain that with my testimony, I submitted a fact sheet we recently prepared on SB 461. I apologize for giving you something with a different bill number on it, but we believe the provisions of that bill are similar enough to this one that you might find the information on that fact sheet useful, and that's why I handed it out. So thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. There has to be a multiplier effect to this too that would hopefully more than offset any fiscal on this. I'm hoping, and if you have any data that you come across that supports that, this is a question everyone's going to testify to. This is a question everyone is going to testify, and I'm going to make the same request to the department to look into other states and just do the math on all, however you figure that stuff out, because I think this would be a positive impact to the economy. So any questions of these good people this morning? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. First, I want to say I think it sounds like a great concept. And are any other states doing this that you know of? I didn't hear you mention it, if you did.
My understanding is that this is a fairly unique bill for Oregon. I can't say that I have had a chance to look into the particulars of job training related provisions in other states' unemployment systems very closely, but from talking to advocates at the National Employment Law Project, which focuses nationally on unemployment insurance issues, they were very intrigued by this kind of work, saying that they had not seen similar things. So my understanding is that it would be an innovative idea in Oregon.
Okay, I follow up.
But would you like to respond to that?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, there are other states which have some structure to support part-time or temporary workers. I'm not familiar with the details of those, but I could go ahead and work with our local employment department to find that out and provide that to the chair.
And that's a question I think we're burning in all of our minds, so I look forward to hearing that answer. Are you follow-up,
well,
Representative?
Yeah, I guess I was wondering... what's contemplated here as far as training? Can it be years, months, all the above? I mean, it seems like that could impact the budget.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, my understanding from the bill's language is it's a maximum of 3 years, so it's possible that a person could come in and out of unemployment, part-time work, and come out of in and out of that kind of status and have a three-year training. I would ask the sponsors of the bill or the writers of the bill to respond more technically around that.
And we'll have the department up here at the end of testimony to help shed some light on those excellent questions. Representative Cameron, then Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming to testify today, Joanne and Joy. And maybe you can answer these questions. One question is, as I have, is what programs qualify for the training and who certifies that? And then I notice in the bill it says that the training and education that provides specific skills required in growth and demand occupations, as determined by the director of the employment department.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know what those occupations are today if this bill is law?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Cameron, yes, we would. The professional technical definition is a very specific type of definition that we already use under other federal funding for the purposes of training. It specifically excludes what's called lower division collegiate college transfer programs, so it's a non-baccalaureate degree. So it would be welders, machinists, automotive, apprenticeship. We have our utility training workers, our energy resource management workers, those that are for some of the newer language that's going around, high-skilled, but they are middle-class type jobs. So they are 2 years or less. They help people get the technical skills in high-wage, high-demand occupations. Nursing and allied health is also in that category as well. The Employment Department publishes regularly the list in the state for high-demand, high-wage occupations. We rely on that at our college to either retool our curriculum or to find where to place people who are interested in a job and in something that is very quick to get, and quick meaning anywhere from a 6-week certificate to a 2-year certificate.
Thank you. Let's see, we've got Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out that there are a number of other states, as testimony has already indicated, that provide for part-time benefits, and I think that number is plus or minus 20 other states that do some form of that. And in terms of training and what constitutes an economically distressed worker, that's actually part of a federal regulation right now. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kenmer.
Madam President, I just wanted to welcome you today, and it's nice to have you here and have the best community college in Oregon recognized. So
thank
just
you.
Want to put that on the record. Excuse me.
Thank Mr. You. Chair, for once I'd like to second Representative Kenmer.
And you get thirds here from the other Clackamas County resident.
Right.
So
And President Roberts isn't here to defend herself.
Well, that's part of the point.
All righty then. Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this might just be a point of clarification, and perhaps it's even for, you know, Teresa, you might be able to help me out. But we have Senate Bill 461, apparently, and House Bill 2624. Both these seem to almost do similar things. Is that consistent, or is that... Are we looking at one versus the other, or are we looking at both at this point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, I haven't had a chance to fully look at Senate Bill 461. It is dealing with unemployment insurance benefits, but it's not. The bills are not identical. Senate Bill 461 deals with UI benefits directly, and then while the House bill that we're looking at deals with worker training primarily.
So. And in the main name, in the sake of full disclosure, Representative Witt and I have been talking about this at length with Senator Rosenbaum, so we don't have things like this going on.
I wouldn't want two good bills to not have one good bill pass as a result of, you know.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you
for
thanks,
asking.
Mr. Chair.
And you're not going to plug Mount Hood while you got the microphone?
I think Dr. Ski's probably watching. He knows how I feel about Mount Hood. So.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Any further questions of these good people?
Yeah, I do have one more question.
And then Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, thank you. Is there any hospitality programs that would qualify for this higher training for management in hospitality or tourism?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Cameron, I'm not sure. Our college does not offer a hospitality program or a culinary program. I'd have to find that out for you, and I could certainly do that.
That'd be
for
good.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher, then Holby.
Thank you. Going back to a couple questions that Representative Cameron asked a little bit ago, I heard an answer to what the growth and demand occupations are, but I didn't pick up on an answer to what programs, what training programs qualify and who would be certifying them.
Okay. Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, a couple of options, I believe, and I'm not familiar with all of the federal law associated with this particular provision. The Oregon Department of Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, along with the Northwest Accreditation Association for our colleges, all have standards which identify career technical education. It is also a definition under the Carl Perkins Career Technical Education Act, which is federal. So those are clearly and specifically laid out. The types of programs, I think, was the other question. Pardon me.
What programs qualify? It sounds like there's some definition federally that would
So it could be medical office assisting, for example, a welding certificate, an automotive collision repair, automotive CAD drafting, business accounting, retail management, a whole host. The hospitality is the area I'm unfamiliar with, so I would need to check in.
All right, thank you. It gives me an idea.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to raise a point that I think needs to be considered. I'm not exactly sure if this bill impacts it, but Oregon already allows certain individuals in apprenticeship programs to collect unemployment while they're attending training. So I want to make sure that this definition does not exclude them from carrying forward with that, and maybe the department can help clarify that.
And I think we share your concern. I know we share your concern, Representative. Thank you. Any further questions of these good folks? All righty then. Thank you very much. Have a good
thank
weekend.
Thank you.
Let's see. Mike Sullivan and Steve Lanning. Good brothers of mine want to go first.
Steve wants me to go first. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director of AWPPW, or I should say the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I am here in support of House Bill 2624. Presently in St. Helens, Boise, Inc. has permanently laid off 350 workers through no fault of their own. But because of the economy and poor trade agreements that we have entered into that allow dirty products to come in our country. Paper as a whole cannot compete. In Cascade Steel, in Representative Thatcher's district in Yamhill County, 350 employees, 80 are laid off presently, and they have a roll-off system where they work 2 weeks and they're off 2 weeks, but they get their hospitalization paid. Talking to the president of the local, and that is my old local, and I worked there for 25 years, he told me last night that there's a strong possibility that the place will shut next month. And then you have White Birch in Representative Thatcher's district, who have 80 people, or 200 laid off until March 8th. They say it's economics, but again, I also point to the idea of trade agreements that have been entered. They think they'll come back in the market, but paper is in a dog-eat-dog market right now. And although the demand for paper is down, production of paper is still going around, but not in this country. We are shipping perfectly good paper machines to China, Vietnam, as we speak. And then again, in Yamhill County, there's ADAC Dental that has laid off 100 workers. And in Polk County, where Bill Cluding represents them, the warehouse plant just permanently shut down, and that was 67 workers. So this bill is extremely important to those that can get trained. The issue, though, is a lot of these places are rural areas, and what are they going to be trained for is a real problem. They say a recession is when you know somebody who got a job loss. Depression is when you lose your job. I myself went through 7 years of four-day work weeks, and it took me 7 years to get my apprenticeship done, but our contract language for Representative Holvey indicated that nobody could work overtime, which allowed us apprentices training to go on. Again, I can't point heavily enough to these trade agreements that have to change. The economy will right itself, but these agreements will still be in place, like the WTO, GATT, NAFTA, and the like. We can't recover from this type of trade agreement issues ever. And there's never been an empire that doesn't have some sort of heavy industry, and we're losing it right now. If World War II was to come today, we couldn't turn around an industry to make a war effort, because we really don't have any industries in this country. And I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Before we go to Steve, hopefully we can train some of these people to draft and write trade agreements that do help this community. But, I would like to see my union brothers and sisters from the public sector in here talking about what you just said, and industry, and ag, and timber, and power, because it's part of the ledger sheet. And when people come and ask for money, they got to help us figure out where we're going to get it. And that's just an outreach to our other friends in labor to come and be more active in this conversation you're talking about right there. All right, I'll get off my soapbox. Steve, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I want to thank this committee and Representative Witt for bringing this bill forward. It comes at a time when it's crucial to workers to have a bill like this being looked at in this body. The training programs that we extend to and the recognition of part-time work is really important. The three concepts that are being looked at in this building around unemployment insurance, the alternative base years on the other side of the building, it's an important bill. It's moving. It gives $90 million from federal funds to the employment program, the unemployment insurance program. As a second choice, we look at this bill as an important bill coming after it, as one of the most important changes that this body can make during this session. We also look at this particular bill with the training and the part-time part of it as an alternative to the Jobs Plus program, a program that's been discontinued, and some members in this body have been looking for a program that would replace it. We think this is a good alternative. And we're also sensitive to the drawing down of the unemployment insurance trust fund and the potential for increasing business taxes. The trust fund is being drawn down, certainly with this economy, and any kind of changes, any kind of expansions at all, could trigger business increases. We recognize that, and that's the way it goes, I guess. But we do recognize it and understand. Of looking at this, we can't see anything negative about it except that it has the potential of drawing down that fund. It's not. It's a good fund. It's a substantial fund. The Employment Department can talk about the nature of the fund, but we can't see anything negative about this bill except that. But it's not enough for us to oppose it. We're certainly in support of it.
And, Steve, I was going to wait until the department got up here, but I went over and discussed it briefly with Representative Witt about putting like a four-year sunset on this bill and see where the fund is at that time and see what kind of impact it's had, not just where the fund or the rate is, but hopefully there'd be some math showing the positive impact on our economy and our ability to bring revenue into this state, because that way we would be able to take a look at it, or the future legislature would be able to take a look at it and then examine where we go from there. Any further questions of these? Any questions of these good gentlemen? Mike, you're exactly right. That's exactly what we need to concentrate on. And it's a community that has come in here harping on that, not just people like you and me. So with that, I'll let you guys go. Before I get talking about timber and gravel and power and water and irrigation.
Thank you for that manufacturing. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Indeed. All righty, and I'm going to call Michael Dale up. Would anyone else, other than the department, because I'm going to bring them up in a minute, would anyone else like to testify to this bill today? And we're not working it today. We don't have all the information. Okay, very good. Michael, whenever you're ready.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Workers Justice Project. We provide legal representation to low-wage workers engaged in temporary employment, part-time employment, contract employment, what labor economists call contingent work. And those workers quite frequently are caught up in a cycle of not having skills, needing work, so they go to work at a low-wage job, which doesn't last. They go on unemployment. They have to find another job to replace their income. They don't have skills there either, so it's another low-wage, dead-end job. And I've seen clients that in a period of 2 years have gone through four or five different jobs and were unemployed. And last year, our last session, we proposed this bill with the notion that we could take an opportunity while someone's unemployed and the resources of the unemployment, and rather than look for work as much as you can and then sit home and watch soap operas, you could be doing something really positive for yourself and for the economy of Oregon. Let's face it, even when we get out of this ditch we're in right now, we're in an economy where it's not going to be how strong your back is, it's going to be what skills you bring to the table. And by investing in our workers, we're investing in the future. We're engaging in stimulus of the economy, because unemployed workers are going to spend every penny of unemployment they get, but they're also building a future for themselves, for Oregon, and for Oregon's economy. The one other point I just add to the written comments that I've made is that the one criticism that I've heard offered of the bill is that now's not the time. You know, we just have too many obligations, too little revenue. It's just not the time to be looking at any kind of new program. I would say that this is the exact time when it is most needed, when it's most crucial, it's going to be most critical. If the projections are right for low-wage, unskilled workers, it's going to be more difficult to find work in this economy over the next couple of years. Why not use those years to build up our workforce and allow people to enter into training programs with the assurance that they're going to be able to finish them? Sometimes there's an economic component to enrolling in a training program. And if you know that if you get a job offer for a two-day job, you're going to have to drop out and accept that job or lose your income, it's not much of an incentive to enroll in that kind of a program. So we think it's a good bill. It was passed out of the Workforce Development Committee on a bipartisan basis in the last session of the Congress, and it got caught up in the very end of the session, and unfortunately wasn't enacted, but we strongly support it and recommend that you adopt it with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. You're right, now is the time. We still don't have the information. We do have to be sensitive to the fiscal debt. We have to be sensitive to any rate increases because that's what we have to do here. But you're right, if ever there was a time to help people increase their skill and their ability to get and keep a job, I can't imagine, in my lifetime, I've never seen a more better opportunity than this. Any questions of Mr. Dale today?
Thank you. Sir.
All right, Tom, I don't know, you, Rebecca, whoever wants to come on up, and I don't think we don't have a fiscal, but if you want to touch on any estimates or guesstimates, and if you know anything about other states, if you want to comment on the sunset idea, which I think that would be prudent, we can examine it, or the future legislature can examine that. Maybe that'll take a little angst off of some people. But anyway, Tom, go ahead whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Byerly, the administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department. Chair Schaffler, if I could, I wonder if you wouldn't mind if I just gave a little overview about unemployment insurance modernization in general, what has been looked at and heard so far on the Senate side, and how it compares with this particular bill. Would that be okay?
Please, go by all means.
All right. Within the current economic stimulus package that was signed by the President last week is a $7 billion distribution nationwide for what's referred to as unemployment insurance modernization. And as Representative Witt commented, when this program was designed in the mid-30s, basically, we're a manufacturing-driven society. People were laid off. They went back to work. It was full-time. Our labor force has changed dramatically over the years, and Congressman McDermott, thank you, McDermott from Washington. I'm just sort of a mannequin here.
Hey, you're looking good.
Congressman McDermott has been pushing on some sort of modernization of the unemployment insurance program for the last 2 years. I was fortunate to hear some hearings on it in Congress myself. At any rate, he wants to make the program more responsive to today's workforce. And so there's an incentive for states to get some administrative money and some trust fund money if they adopt those pieces. At the top of the list is an alternate base period. 20 states now have an alternate base period that's different than what we file unemployment insurance claims on now. We use the regular period of the first four of the last five completed calendar quarters. And if someone doesn't qualify under that base period, an alternate would mean we would move up a quarter where we probably don't have wage information. We would have to go after it manually. But we think about 6,000 more people would qualify for benefits if we did that. That bill has been heard in the Senate Commerce and Economic Development. It is passed on to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. That bill is a key to getting $85 million of trust fund money and $5 million of administrative money into our trust fund for Oregon. Once we have that in place, then we qualify for the second two-thirds of our share, which totals the $90 million I mentioned. Also a part of unemployment insurance modernization is reaching out to part-time workers. Part-time workers or employers pay unemployment insurance tax on part-time workers just like they pay on their full-time workers. Yet in Oregon, to be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits, you need to be willing to seek and accept full-time work, even if there are some very legitimate reasons that you are only able to work part-time. Senate Bill 463 would allow workers that qualified for benefits as a part-time worker. Let's say they work 20 hours a week, and they would then be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits if they lost that part-time job, as long as they're willing to seek and accept work that was equal to what they qualified under. Moving further, Senate Bill 461 is real similar to House Bill 2624. It provides training to economically distressed workers, workers that are making 110% of the minimum wage less and are unable to get full-time work or basically are underemployed or want to improve themselves. The difference in 461 to 2624 is it has a work experience or on-the-job training component that we're working with the federal government on getting language in. So it has the same provisions of this bill, the same kind of classroom trainings, the same kind of proprietary trainings, the same kind of apprenticeships, but it adds, again, maybe an OJT component. So real similar to 2624.
Oh, you finished, Mr. Biden?
Well, yes.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions,
yeah.
Representative?
Happy
Cameron,
to answer questions.
Then Representative Matthews.
Tom, thank you for being here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious as to how this is going to get paid for. And according to 461, or at least some fact sheets that we were handed out, that even if the employee leaves voluntarily, they're eligible for the benefits to go through the training. Can you tell me where that charge is going to go for those unemployment benefits, even if the person leaves voluntarily to take this training?
The Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Cameron, the charges would be pooled in the fund. It would not be charged to an individual employer. If dislocated workers that are in training or workers in this training program, if you're a tax-paying employer, we don't charge that employer account for those benefits while they're in training.
Yeah, so an employee leaves the job, they file for unemployment benefits, and then they get into this training. At what point in time does the previous employer get notified that their account is now relieved of those charges? How does that transpire?
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Cameron, that's a good question. And this particular provision of allowing of individuals to leave work is real similar to what we do now for dislocated workers, although it's not. I think we may want to suggest a little bit more clarity in the law, and here's how it's intended to work. An individual is unemployed through no fault of their own and qualifies for unemployment insurance benefits. They want to better themselves. They want to enter training. So we allow them to apply for training with our workforce partners. And sometimes, and actually more often than not, that training doesn't start right away. Unfortunately, community college terms don't like to coincide with layoffs. It's funny how that works for us. And so our workforce partners do a really good job of saying, hey, you know, if you went and took a survival job, you could extend the life of your unemployment insurance claim longer, and then when your training begins, we would let you leave that survival job to start training. So it's not so much that you would leave your work that you have now that's expected to continue to enter training. It's leaving a survival job so you could go back to training or continue training. Or let's say it comes up in the summertime. There's a summer break and your program isn't offered in the summer, so you would take again a survival job and need to go back to school in the fall. The intent is to help workers move along the continuum and better themselves so they don't have to stay in the low-wage jobs.
Okay. But just follow up, if I may. Just to clarify, this will not be put on the back of an individual employer. Obviously, the employers that have people that would qualify for this in the charges back to their accounts. It's coming out of the general trust fund spread out over all employers.
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Cameron, that's correct. It's intended to be pooled across the fund.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Representative Matthews.
And I appreciate the line of questioning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that's kind of what my mind was going to, was the difference in the two. And I know we're not working either one. It's hard to ignore the voluntarily quitting their job to enter the training voluntarily. When I think about small business and the demand of small business, the recruitment and retention is a problem for everybody. And I could see that if a small business were to lose a couple employees that got together and thought, hey, we should enter that training program, that would be pretty devastating. And I think House Bill 2624 actually is about the dislocated workers, and it doesn't offer that. Am I correct? 2624 doesn't offer the voluntarily leaving a position for the program?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Matthews, dislocated workers now have a provision in our law where they can leave work of a survival job while they're waiting for training to start or to resume after a break or something like that. That is currently in statute, and this was modeled after that. And again, it may not be, we may need to tinker with it a little bit so we're ensuring that people aren't leaving work up front to go into training, but are leaving work of a survival job so they can resume their training.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're using this term survival job, and I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. So what is survival job?
I'm sorry.
A legislator. They're barely surviving, baby.
For the record, that was Chair Schaffler's comment. Survival jobs would be just... I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but let's say working at the state fair. You need a little bit of money to get you by. Or maybe you go out and you work in the fields because that's all you can do for right now. Or you pick up a part-time job at a gas station, something like that, just to get you by. Not something that maybe in your mind you want to make a career, but you need something to provide income to your family to survive until you can get back to school.
There's no statutory definition, though. It's just a term we use. Or is there?
Chair Schaffler, I don't know if there is a statutory definition of that.
I think we get the gist, and if we don't, we'll be back to you on it. Are you satisfied with that, Representative?
Yeah, that's what I think.
All right, Representative Kennerman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, there's a category of people who work part-time who qualify for no benefits, I guess, as contract employees. Is that correct? Are contractors, not employees? I guess that's the distinction that's made. You know, I'm reflecting back to a long time ago, for example, when I taught part-time at Mount Hood Community College. As I recall, there were absolutely no benefits to that other than the wage. No unemployment, no health insurance, no... And I'd see that in other contracts.
Representative Kenner, that would be like an independent contractor union?
Yes.
That's correct. They would not be able to qualify for benefits.
And I guess the question that I have, and it's sort of related to the pool and the impact on the pool, do we have any data that tells us whether that pool of independent contractors is increasing? Because my sense is that it is, both as a mechanism to reduce cost and as a way to, I don't know. I maybe will not editorialize more at the moment. I do know, for example, a bill is circulating trying to rein this in certain instances.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Kenmer, I'm not aware of any data that would show that is on the increase. Wouldn't disagree that it needs to be examined, however.
Well, the representative is correct, and I'm fairly confident we are going to be having a long, good, at least one or two days discussing that very issue, independent contractor, which I gleefully look forward to.
Chair Schaffler, I wonder if it would be okay if I offer a little bit of information.
Please,
about our trust
go
fund.
Ahead. Yes, sir.
The Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund in Oregon is one of the most solvent in the United States. I'm very proud to report. We have 8 tax schedules that unemployment insurance taxes are levied on employers. We're in tax schedule 3 of 8 right now for all of this calendar year, 2009. And we have a little chart that shows the tax rate schedules and where we are right now, if we could have those passed out. Hope you have a moment for just a little bit of a
please, go ahead,
discussion on this. Right, again, as I said, we're in tax rate schedule 3, and what that means is we're actually paying out more than we're collecting in unemployment insurance taxes. If we're in schedule 4, that's our equilibrium schedule, where we'd be collecting in roughly what we're paying out. We are in schedule 3 because let's face it, our unemployment rate was very good, it was very healthy. and our economy is very healthy. And we made the projections for what we needed for calendar year 2009, last September 2008. And you'll recall about that time, our unemployment rate was probably around 5.4%. Subsequent to that, it has exploded. And so we're obviously paying out a lot more money right now. Based on the expenditures that we're seeing and looking at our trust fund solvency, because of the fund is self-correcting in law, we are projecting that we'll probably go to Schedule 5 at the beginning of calendar year 2010. Now, depending on how much we draw out of the trust fund, we could be in risk of going to Schedule 6. We don't know. It depends on again, how the economy goes as the year progresses, because we'll be doing another calculation this coming September. For calendar year 2011, at the current rate, we're projecting to be in tax rate Schedule 7 and possibly 8, again, just depending on the economy. This could all come into, this could all change depending on how many provisions are passed this legislature that would draw down the trust fund. Please don't hear me sitting here saying that any bill is a bad idea. That's not my point. I just want to make sure that all the information is out about the potential impact of the trust fund should we pay out more benefits. I know the fiscal impact statement is not in yet, but we're estimating that this particular bill would draw down about $9 million a year out of the trust fund. We estimate about 4,000 participants a year would take advantage of this program.
Well, the as unemployment goes up, this graph goes down. As unemployment goes down, this rate eventually goes down too. The more people you got working, the lower the rate. And the idea behind the bill is to get more people working, and I would hope at more better wages, which would be exactly the cure for that increasing rate. So,
Chair Shoffler,
if I got this figured out in my own brain here,
Mr. Chair, thank you for reminding us something I wanted to say. In our dislocated worker programs that we have for training, we do see a less likelihood of, if someone completes their training, of coming back on unemployment insurance. We have seen that effect.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Holby, then Cameron, then Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have two questions.
Please.
The first question, Tom, is, so your rough estimate is this bill could draw down our trust fund by $9 million currently. But at the beginning of your testimony, you mentioned that passing some of these types of modernization acts would make us eligible for federal monies. So does that $9 million figure account for any kind of federal money that would come in because we adopt this kind of a program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, that's an excellent question. Thank you. If we put the $90 million in the trust fund, that would obviously help us stave off a potential tax rate increase sooner than later. In our projections, we were looking at going to Schedule 5, possibly 6. If we had the $90 million, that might keep us from going to 6. It just all depends, again, how much we draw out and how many additional provisions are passed that would draw down the trust fund. But that $90 million going to the trust fund definitely would help. That's very true.
Representative, any more?
I have one other question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, my second question was, I alluded to it a little earlier, is this the same statute that currently allows people to go into training as they're required to, and so they're off work while attending training in the case of apprenticeship, so they can collect unemployment while they're attending that training, that professional training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, this is a statute just in front of that one. No, this is a different law.
Okay.
Union apprentices have their own separate subsection in our chapter.
And the language in this would not impact that particular statute?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And then before I go to Representative Cameron, we could go to the Schedule 6 even without this law, right? Even without this legislation. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's the potential.
Right. So, okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I know we're looking at percentages on these graphs, but can we talk about what those percentages really mean? For example, if we're in a 197, is that, and somebody has a good experience rating as an employer, is that what their percentage of their total payroll is they're going to pay in unemployment insurance, for example, under Schedule 3? So if you had $1 million payroll, would that be a...
Chair Schaffler, Vice Chair Cameron, this is the average rate in that schedule. You potentially could be a little lower than this if your experience was excellent. I'm sorry I don't have the percentage off the top of my head, but I'll get it for you.
But this is just the average then. So if we're looking, because we're talking about a pool here that we were talking about, it wouldn't impact any individual employer. So let's use the average number. The 197 to an employer that has $1 million in payroll is how much?
Well, the 1.97% is paid on the first $31,300 of an individual's wage. So
let's assume it all came under that.
Okay. I don't know the math. I'm not that sharp.
Okay.
We just get a calculator and we can figure it out.
I can get it.
Can you do a few scenarios for us?
Absolutely.
Great. That'd be good.
I'm sorry I can't do the math.
Well, okay. What I wanted to know was an employer that if they had $1 million in payroll today, if they were on a Schedule 3 and it jumps to a Schedule 5. What's the difference in the tax burden?
Okay. We can do that.
Get that. Do more than one scenario and get it to all of us so we all can get our handle on this. Representative Thatcher, please.
Thank you. Following up once again on a question that the good representative Cameron asked earlier about how this is financed. I want to know actually how the training is actually coming, the cost of the training is actually coming out of the UI fund as well, correct?
Chair Schaffer, Representative Thatcher, the training is not paid for from this fund specifically. What we work with our WIA, our Workforce Investment Act partners, and the community colleges, and they come up with financing for the training. It can be a variety of Workforce Investment Act adult funds. It could be Pell Grants. It could be a relative loan. It could be a savings account. The money we're contemplating here is just strictly income support from unemployment insurance. If they have enough left over to help pay for the training, that's great, but it's not solely intended to pay for the training.
And that leads me to the next question. If they have enough left over, how much would one earning 110% of the minimum wage get in an unemployment check, assuming they were full-time?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Thatcher, I probably should have made that last comment because their unemployment may be around the neighborhood of $120 a week if this was all they were making, especially if they were part-time.
So there probably wouldn't be much left over. Okay.
That'd be correct.
Not if they want to eat.
I apologize.
All righty then. Any further questions of Mr. Byerly today? Whenever you get all that info, get it back to us, please. I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Anyone else like to testify this bill today? It was a great discussion. I look forward to getting that information. And I think we should do this. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2624 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2595.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2595 requires home health agencies and hospice programs to compensate nurses that provide home health services or hospice services on an hourly basis and also prohibits nurses from providing such services on a to receive compensation on a per visit basis. The measure also requires the Department of Human Services to enforce the compliance of hospice programs that provide these services on an hourly basis.
Great. There's four people right now. I'm going to call them two at a time. Brian DeLashmit and Billy Landros, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian DeLashmit, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. For many of you who are on the interim committee, this is not a new issue. It was in front of the interim committee, I believe, around May. So we'll try not to replow some of that existing ground with those members, but I do know that there are some members here that were not on that committee, and we'll try and be as complete and thorough as we can possibly be. During the interim committee, the committee chair and the committee asked us to do a couple of things. One is to see if we couldn't come to some agreement with the Home Health and Hospice Association. And I will go through the actual morphing of the bill. The bill that you see in front of you right now is continues to be amended, and there will be a Dash 3 amendment that the actual staff has not even seen yet, but I'll walk you through it as well. The second thing that you ask us to do is to gather additional information on what the status of hospice and home health was in this state, what kind of problem was occurring, what the working conditions were, and so forth. And I do have a survey that I'm going to spend a little time on, but not much, because you can, of course, read it yourself. With that, let me direct you to the cover sheet that looks like this from ONA. And attached to that should be the actual House bill. Let me walk you through a couple of changes. The two major changes that we are proposing in this bill is the deletion on line 8 and on line 13 of an hourly basis only. The effect of that is instead of requiring these hospice and home health agencies to only pay on an hourly basis, this would allow them to pay on a salary basis or some other combination, but not require them to only pay on an hourly basis. If you understand the base concept of this bill and what we're trying to get at, we're trying to avoid a situation in which there is an economic incentive for a nurse to shortcut treatment when they're going out for hospice and home health. And we will be real frank with you. There are some nurses that perhaps could actually do better economically under that kind of model. We professionally do not believe that that's the model the state of Oregon should be going down. And so we strongly believe in this bill. But that change is something that we've discussed with the hospice and home health agencies, allows them some flexibility that, in fact, they could pay a salary if it was agreed to by the nurses. The next issue is on line 18. This is more of a drafting. It should be enforcement of sections 2 and 4. And the third thing, and this is a little bit of a shift in the direction of this bill, but we've decided after making the changes in line 8 and 13 that actually what we're dealing with here is the enforcement by BOLI rather than the enforcement by the health division. And so we're suggesting those changes. The bill, when it comes back to you, hopefully with the Dash 3 amendments, will reflect those changes accurately and you'll be able to move on it. Let me touch on one very brief issue before I go through the survey that we put together. The Oregon Nurses Association and our members are not blind to the issue that's really driving this whole situation with home health and hospice. The issue here is reimbursement rates. And we stand alongside the hospice and home health agencies, understanding that unless we deal with the issue of Medicaid reimbursement rates in this state that are adequate to provide services to people in their homes through these agencies, that this system will fail. And we have committed with that other group that we will work with them on that issue, which we think is really the backbone that needs to be strengthened in order for us all to be doing the job that we need to be doing and providing the care that we need to be providing. I can look around the committee. I don't know if all of you have experienced either with a relative or a parent hospice and home health. I am currently experiencing that. My brother is in final stages of cancer, I understand what these folks do. Turning to the survey now, very quickly, a lot of the initial information, and I'll skip you to about the third full page, obviously demographics starts the initial part of the survey off. Let me turn to the lower right hand. It says Home Health Nursing Practice Survey.
Hold up what you got there, Brian.
Sweeney. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
I'm turning one sheet, two sheets. So it's actually page 5, but it's the third sheet.
All right.
I want to just point out.
For future reference, would you number them for me for future reference?
I will make sure that is accomplished.
And it's the top one says home health and hospice nursing type of practice.
Yeah.
Is that where we're at, that graph?
Yes.
Thank you.
And the box that I'm going to read from or look at is in the lower right-hand corner here. It says, in my agency,
right.
And there's an N198. Concerns for patients paramount. I want to point out that very, very plainly, if you add agree or strongly agree with that statement, you're seeing a demonstration by the nurses who were surveyed in this that their concern for the patient is foremost. It's above and beyond all other issues, including pay. If you can turn to the next page, within a year, year's period of time, how often did you work beyond your scheduled hours? And it breaks it down by different things. Documentation, 53.8%. Patient teaching, 37%. Just to give you a flavor of this is not going out and just providing the essential nursing care. Major components of nursing care, especially in these kinds of settings, are not only doing the paperwork, but patient teaching and interacting with the family. And so we wanted to highlight that as well. How often did you work overtime down below that? Were you compensated? 36% on documentation say they were compensated. 30.9% did get some overtime. 30.7% said there was no compensation. Demonstration there is that these people are so committed to their jobs that they will they'll work that extra hour, 2 hours, as all of us do, in the evening to complete their paperwork off the clock. And there's a major component of that because the paperwork is so such a large component. When you work overtime, what amount of time do you work beyond your scheduled hours? Majority is in the 30-minute to 60-minute. I suspect if we would have gone to 60 to 90 minutes, it may have been a large component as well. And then, of course, it's broken down by the different components that are there. Major direct nursing care challenges, patients with difficult medical complications.
Some of these folks do a lot of driving. Do they get paid extra for that, the wear and tear on their vehicle, gas, whatever?
Actually, if you hold off until the three nurses come up, they can answer that question.
Thank you.
And
folks, we're done at 10 o'clock. We asked a lot of questions on the last one. Not trying to shortchange you.
Yeah.
But just keep that in mind. And I'll try and keep my mouth shut.
And sometimes less is more, so I will try and be extremely brief now. But patients with difficult medical complications, a lot of times when these folks go out, there is something that's new, that's a complication. You can't be expected to know exactly what you're going to walk into when you go out there. It could be a family situation. It could be some other complication, medical complication. But it could also be other complications that will arise. And they have to have the flexibility to be able to deal with those. With that, I'm not going to spend any more time on the survey. Obviously, you can read it yourself. I hope you listen intently, and I know you will, with the nurses that are going to come and tell their story that work in this particular area. I believe they're not only going to tell you why they think this is a good idea, but also give you a sample of what they see every day. And with that, I'll end my testimony.
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm Billy Lindros. I'm a registered nurse from Eugene, Oregon. I'm speaking in support of House Bill 2595. I'm a working hospice nurse in Eugene. I drive around in my car to see patients in their homes and in facilities. We are compensated for our driving at our hourly rate where I work, and then people get paid the IRS standard rate for use of their private vehicles, which I think is what most agencies do. What we do is, as I said, we drive around in our cars and see patients, typically in home settings or in facilities. who are our clients for home health. Patients are supposed to be homebound, which means they're typically elderly people who it's difficult for them to leave their home. Oftentimes they have complicated medical situations. For hospice, it's terminal patients who their physicians have certified that they have a life expectancy of 6 months or less. That can include patients with cancer, heart disease, respiratory disease, dementia, and then other, you know, effects of aging oftentimes. They're referred to us by their physicians. Oftentimes the family, there's an intensive discussion between the physician and the patient and family to decide that they're not, that they need to be either on home health or hospice. So it's a collaborative decision that's made. Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance typically pays for our services. And most nurses are paid on an hourly basis throughout the state. What we're seeing happening and what's of concern to us is that there's nonprofit and for-profit home health and hospice agencies, and we're sensing a movement of more out-of-state for-profit agencies trying to move into the state of Oregon and kind of take over the industry, and we're concerned about that primarily because of the impact on our patients. Why is that of concern? The not-for-profit agencies, which is who I work for. I work for Sacred Heart Home Health Services in Eugene, and we're a pretty good-sized home health and hospice agency. We take all patients. We don't discriminate when a referral comes in from a physician's office. We don't say, well, that person doesn't have insurance for hospice, we're not going to see them, or that person sounds like they're somebody that we're not going to make any money off, so we won't take that referral. We take all comers, and oftentimes the people who have the least amount of compensation to pay for their care are the people who have the highest need because they're poor, don't have insurance, are in socially challenged situations, but we take those on. Our belief is that for-profit agencies tend to do what I think is colloquially known as cherry-picking, to just pick out the more profitable patients to take on service. And we feel like this type of a pay-per-visit compensation model drives down nursing wages, and it's kind of a race to the bottom. At our agency, we have a new manager in the last couple of years that I've worked closely because I'm involved with the nursing union at our agency, and he has told me how much he likes having the union involved because we've been able to maintain wages and have experienced, very competent nurses who are caring for our patients. Where he worked before, wages were substandard, people didn't stay, there was rapid turnover, and the experience and expertise was not as good as it is where I work now. Why should the legislature care about this bill? I think it'll pay-per-visit compensation for hospice and home health nurses will have a negative effect on the not-for-profit agencies. It'll clearly have a negative effect on the nurses. It'll make our jobs harder. It will make challenging ethical decisions for us as far as, do I spend the requisite amount of time to see this patient or do I jump in my car and run on to the next one because I have to squeeze in X number of visits in order to pay the bills that we all have to pay. Pay-per-visit schemes typically don't recognize all the things that Brian referenced that are the other things we do that when we're not in the patient's home, time on the phone, time talking to physician, care planning, talking to our other people at our agency, social workers and bath aides and managers and all those other people. And it also fosters unprofessional competition between nurses for the quickest, closest, and easiest visits. But most importantly, it'll have a severe negative impact on our patients. These are human beings. Oftentimes, they're ill. They're old. They're sick, they're dying, they can't be rushed. You have to take your time with them. You're going in and seeing an 80-year-old lady who's trying to stay at home, trying to maintain her independence and dignity, has 15 medications that she's taking are complicated. It just takes time. And often the folks who take the most time are people out in the country. I've been a nurse in Eugene. I've been a nurse in Cottage Grove. You go into a home in the country, you got to sit down and go a little bit slower than somebody who's a more urbanite type person, faster with the pickup and so forth. And those are the people who need the help the most. It's not an assembly line. We're not bolting fenders on Fords or Toyotas. We're dealing with fragile, medically challenged people who take time. I'll talk a little bit about a situation I dealt with recently because I think the human element tends to be important in these types of discussions. 2 weekends ago, I was working on the weekend. During the week, I see my normal patients, and I have a caseload that I carry. But on the weekend, I drive around and see patients who are having problems and kind of put out fires, as we put it. I'm based in Eugene. Drove up the Mackenzie River because we knew there was a patient up there who was, as we term it, actively dying, and we thought we needed to get up there and see what was going on and provide support to the family. I got there. Fellow was dying. Actually, he died the next day. His wife was caring for him alone with some support from her church, which was supportive to her. Very good. Family was coming from out of town. Not there yet. I spent an hour sitting and talking to this lady. I didn't do anything technical. I talked, and I mostly listened. She had a lot of issues and angst that she was working through as far as her husband's death, as you can imagine. And what I provided was supportive listening and presence, perhaps shared a few insights with her. But by being there with her, it had to happen that day, and I had to take the time for that. I couldn't spread that visit over the next week or two. He died the next day. It had to happen that day. Hospice work is kind of like in the old days of sailing ships. They used to say, time and tide waits for no man. It's the same kind of situation. You have to put the time in. And I wasn't sitting there looking at my wristwatch thinking about I had to get back to Eugene to see this other patient and this other patient. I took the time, and it was very rewarding because I knew it could not happen any other time. When I heard he died the next day, I felt gratified that I had had the time to be able to do that. That's sort of the emotional family support component of what we do. You've received written testimony from Teta Norfeld, who's one of my peers at the agency that I work with, who describes seeing patients in rural areas like Drain and some technical nature of our work as well, where we're dealing with complex medications, wound care, IVs, and other stuff, which takes time as well. And what's really crucial with our patients, particularly with hospice and with home health, is the family is doing a lot of this care. I tell hospice families all the time, you're functioning as the nurse, sometimes the doctor, the social worker, you're the financial planner, you're the public relations specialist because you're communicating with all those family members calling from Chicago and California about what's going on. You're the home maintenance specialist. You're the chief cook and bottle washer, and they need the help and support. They're doing a tremendous amount to allow these patients to be cared for at home where they want to be and providing comfortable care and support at home. And it takes time, and nurses professionally need the time to do the job properly, and families and patients need the time spent with them as well. So I thank you for listening, and happy to entertain any further questions.
You know, you said it's an emotional part of it, but, you know, I think that's part of the technical side of it, too. I mean, I don't know anything about what you do, and I could never do your job. But and as far as the quantity versus quality in the assembly line, my wife's a dentist, and she'll sit right here and tell you that, you know, you cannot get in a hurry. You have to spend the time to do the technical work properly, or you're going to be right back there. Do you have malpractice? Are you guys under malpractice then, too? I'm showing my ignorance here.
Nurses can buy private malpractice insurance. Generally speaking, our employers back us up, and I've never heard of a hospice nurse being sued for malpractice.
Right. Well, I'm glad you were there for that situation. Representative Holby, then Representative Cameron, and then Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative
Cameron, I was just...
Then Matthews, then Cameron. Thank you, Representative Holy, for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really feel compelled to comment on this. I'm pretty passionate about this issue. Specifically, I've gone through hospice 4 different times with family members. The first time back in 1987, and you know, there's a big difference from back then to today. For sure, and it just seems absurd to me that somebody would get paid per visit in these kinds of scenarios. Back in 1987, a hospice nurse was doing the best she could, but as Billy just noted, you know, patients don't die according to a watch. When they have needs and they're in distress, and the family member can't deal with it, it becomes a very, very emotional situation. And in fact, when that happens and the hospice nurse had left because they have to make a living and move on to the next project, you could call it that, you know, at that point, we end up freaking out and taking the person to the hospital. Hospice is a cost-effective way to, in a very, very compassionate way, to have a family member pass away. It's a difficult, difficult thing to go through. My hat's off to everybody that works in hospice, because they not only help the patient die comfortably, but they help the family deal with it at the same time. And to have somebody say, well, your time's up, I got to go, and just leave you hanging, that's a really, really bad scenario to go through. And I've been through it, and my hat's off to hospice, and they, you know, this is a paper visit. Should not be allowed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative, very much. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for what it is you do. And with that said, I respect Representative Holvey's comments, and indeed I'm inclined to support this bill and give you what you're asking for. However, the fundamental problem at issue in this bill is that there's really not a good way to compensate professional services who typically deal with atypical situations and require time. There's just not a good way to do so, and I strongly believe that by shifting the essentially how these services are compensated, we're exchanging one set of problems for another. I myself am a lawyer. I bill hourly. I assure you that I bitterly resent it every single day of my life. My colleagues, as I'd say, it's almost unanimous, the hatred for the hourly compensation, because I assure you, I mean, once again, you're just exchanging a different kind of commodification of our labor, and it is I say be careful what you ask for, because it is deeply unpleasant and very unfulfilling.
Thank you, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Billy, a comment for you. Great testimony, and thank you very much for what you do, and to the nurses that are here as well. I don't know if we'll be hearing from you, but we have your written testimony, and thank you. I think one of the things that you touched on in your testimony is, I think one of the, and Representative Holvey is going down that path too, and that is the thing that people don't understand about nurses. And until you have a loved one or you're touched by that, I myself, I'm a firefighter, and we work with hospice often. And I think, you know, probably the biggest benefit that anybody can have with hospice is, first of all, you're being cared for by somebody that absolutely cares about, you know, your family member. But the other thing is, you're protecting people's dignity, and you're allowing them to go as their family sees fit. You're allowing them oftentimes to stay in their own homes and go on their own terms. And I just think that what you bring to people, it's not pleasant. You know, what we're not going to talk about is when you have to, you know, bathe the person on the spot and clean up after a mess that perhaps nobody else would be able to handle, but you go into it with what I call whatever the day demands. And I think your line of duty is something that I just absolutely hold you to the highest standard. I appreciate what you do. You folks really do a great deal and a great service to the community. And my question for the bill would be that on line 13, it does say nurses providing such service may not be compensated on a per pay visit. And I just wonder if we shouldn't say shall. It's just a member that negotiates a lot of contract language, you know, may and shall. I know it seems very insignificant, but shall is sometimes viewed as a very harsher language and able to enforce. So to you, Brian, I don't know. But to you and all your nurses, thanks again for your service and what you do, not only in your caring, your professional treatment, but extending beyond that, and then again, what you're doing for the family of your patients as well. So thank you for everything you're doing. Thanks for your sacrifice.
Thank you on my behalf of my peers for your kind words.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here again. I know we heard this issue during the interim, and Brian and many others here have experienced this in our families and the great benefit that we all achieve from that. That being said, I was out of the room when I think the issue was brought up that we were going to delete the only line 8 and
line 8,
13.
Yeah, line 8 and line 13. The on an hourly basis only is being deleted, so that would allow the flexibility of them either being salaried or they could be paid by the some combination of an hourly wage or a salary, but does not require them to only be paid on an hourly basis. So it leaves flexibility, and this is something that we had talked to the home health and hospice agencies for some flexibility. So it changes the requirement that it only be on an hourly basis.
So a follow-up, if I may. So how does that reconcile with the next sentence, the nurses providing such services may not or shall not be compensated on a per-visit basis? So if I'm on a salary,
if you're on a, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, if you're on a salary, then there is no tie to the actual compensation for that individual visit. The same way as I am on a retainer and I'm here, it doesn't matter how many times I appear in front of a committee or how many times I testify, I'm not getting paid by the hour, I'm getting paid by the job. So a salaried person could in fact be going out and would not be compensated by the visit. So I don't know that those two statements are in conflict the way they're written.
So, Mr. Peter, if I may, so as a manager, you know, sitting down with the employee who's on salary, would I have a discussion of saying, you know, we're only hitting 5 visits a day and we should be hitting 6 visits a day?
Actually, Billy may be the best one to have that discussion, but I assume right now that discussion already goes on. You know, if somebody in that agency is hitting a higher number of folks but still doing the quality job that we really want to see done, and other folks are not doing that, I suspect that discussion already occurs, and we don't believe that would be altered by this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron. Yeah, I think they call that management, basically. That's something that a manager does, and we have productivity standards that we're supposed to meet. I'm typically practice in a more urban area, so I'm able to see more patients than the nurses who are going to Drain and Cottage Grove or going to Oak Ridge and Blue River. So it's a little bit of a balancing act. If I just saw one patient a day and went to McDonald's and read the newspaper, I would certainly have some hard questions to answer when I came back to the office. What happens with pay-per-visit is that it encourages people who want to have a strong profit motive to do very quick cursory visits and really do an inappropriately high number of visits to increase their compensation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I just, before I go to Representative Holby, I want to get on the record that Sarah Myers, who represents the agencies, had a meeting at 9 o'clock, and we went far, because of protocol, when a legislator has a bill, that bill goes first. And I just wanted, in case her clients are watching, she was here and had to go. She can't be in two places at one time. But we will have an opportunity for her and anyone else from the agencies, whether it's a nonprofit or private, to come and talk and testify on this bill. I just wanted to get that out there. Representative Holby, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up with Representative Cameron's question about, you know, managing how many visits staff make on a particular day. That, you know, from my experience, some patients, depending on what stage of illness they're in, take a considerably longer amount of time than others. And so one nurse may be doing preliminary stages, which would allow them to do a lot more patients, where another nurse may be doing more of the end of life, which may take quite a bit longer. So I think that's the managerial decision on which nurse does what. So how many visits doesn't necessarily, you know, mean anything in that regard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paulby, I think that's a very valuable point. My brother is on 24-hour care right now, so that nurse is seeing him and only him.
Every patient's different. You can't just say, I'm going to hit 5 or 6. from what I understand, and my family's had to go through these things as well. Representative, we're finished.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move on because I want to get these nice people up here to talk.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we will have a brief public hearing before when and if we work this bill. I intend to work it because I want Sarah to get a chance to get up and talk. So I'm going to call Robin Kaiser and Elaine Dragomir. I hope I'm saying that right. Come on up. And if you want to touch on anything that you've heard up here that's outside of your testimony, please do. But keep in mind, at 10 o'clock, we're done, and I don't want to short you guys, but I hope you understand.
I think I'm going to have Robin go first just because she's a home health nurse, and you've already heard a lot about hospice.
Very good.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'll try not to be repetitive. Billy did a really nice job. First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about what I do. I've been a home health nurse for...
For the record, your name, please.
Okay, I'm sorry. My name is Robin Kaiser, and I've been a nurse for 30 years. I've worked in home health specifically for 14 years as a psychiatric home health nurse. And so I see primarily psychiatric patients. I also see patients that have medical problems as well. And we've had a lot of changes in our agency over the last several years. Initially, I worked for Legacy Home Health, and we were bought out by Legacy was a nonprofit. We were bought out by a for-profit about 4 years ago, and we have changed hands 2 more times since then. So in 14 years, I've worked at the same agency, but I worked for 4 different employers. And there's been a lot of changes going from a nonprofit to a for-profit. And one of the things that have come into the forefront is the pay-per-visit dilemma. The company that I work for now is called Amedisys. It's a national company out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And they employ a pay-per-visit system for most of their employees all over the United States. The physical therapists, occupational therapists, social workers, home health aides, everybody but the nurses has already gone to this model. And the only reason we haven't is because we have a union contract with ONA, and they represented us, and we were able to negotiate preventing that for the next 2 years in our contract. So we're hoping to get some legislative action on this to prevent that in the future. Anyway, Amedisys would like us to go on pay-per-visit as well eventually, although there's no timeline for that. Because the therapists have already gone onto the system, we know kind of how it works. And there is compensation apparently for a person's experience, longevity with the company. Everybody has a different rate per visit. Longer visits, admission visits are reimbursed at a larger rate than regular visits. The time spent traveling to the patient's home is included in the visit, so that if you spend 10 minutes traveling from one home to another, you get paid the same as somebody who spends 45 minutes in a rural area going to somebody's home. So it's all supposed to be packaged in the visit, although you do get reimbursed for your mileage. As a mental health nurse, most of my clients are pretty complex. They have most of them are elderly with dementia or depression or both. And they might also have medical problems, but they have special cognitive and emotional needs, and they take extra time. I can't always talk to the patient and ask them how they're doing. I can't say, hi, how is your antipsychotic working? I have to talk to different people that take care of them. I have to talk to caregivers. I have to talk to family members. I have to communicate with all these different people in order to get the information that I need, because the patient can't usually tell me. Also, in addition to that, other things may come up at the visit. I'm responsible for their medical needs as well as their psychiatric needs. So if somebody's blood pressure is up, I need to call the doctor. I might need to get some medication adjustment. And if there's a new wound, I have to pay attention to that. I can't just walk out and say, I'll send another nurse tomorrow. I've got to deal with all that at the visit, whatever happens. And over the last few years, I think we've all seen that the patients that we see in the home are a lot more acute. There's been this push to get people out of the hospital and into a home setting or an assisted living or foster home, and then we're involved in their care. visits, because they're more acute, they're not as predictable as they used to be. It used to be you'd go for wound care, you'd go for a blood draw, and that would be it. But now, a lot of times, you find all these other issues when you go out. Just a few weeks ago, I had a patient crawl to the door to answer the door. She wasn't able to walk, but she crawled to the door to let me in. So it took me a good 20 minutes to get her into her wheelchair and into her bed where I could talk with her and find out how she was doing. On numerous occasions, I've had to send patients back to the hospital, and that involves a lot of coordination, calling doctor's office, calling the emergency room to let them know that they're coming, and calling for the ambulance. And usually, if I'm the only person there, I will wait for the ambulance to arrive and give the ambulance drivers, EMTs, information that they're going to need when they take the patient to the hospital. So that can be an hour and a half or 2 hours if that happens. And it's happening more and more because people are more acute. Another issue that isn't addressed by pay-per-visit adequately is that of the case manager. Most of the home health nurses that I work with also function as case managers, and because of that, they're coordinating care with family members and other healthcare professionals, and that takes time, takes a lot of phone calls. Most of the nurses that I work with might have 30 to 40 patients on their caseload. I have less than that being a psychiatric nurse, but the medical nurses carry that many patients. And they spend a lot of time communicating, and that's something that can't be shortchanged. With my elderly patients, especially the ones with dementia, I often have family members that are out of town, so they want to call me and find out how the person is doing, what my recommendations are, what I'd like to do with this person. So a lot of times those phone calls are quite lengthy. Although I try to limit them, you can't eliminate them completely. And in closing, I just want to say that I became a nurse because I wanted to help people and I wanted to provide a good quality of care. And working in a pay-per-visit system provides a real ethical dilemma for me in that sense that I think that it would really impact the level of care that I feel comfortable providing, and it would provide some incentive to get done as quick as possible. This whole issue of quality versus quantity comes to mind, and I want to emphasize that what we do is not predictable, and it's not piecework like in a factory, and I don't feel like we should be compensated this way. I feel like the patient has a certain right. When I go in that door, I want to address all the issues related to that patient that day. And the patients have the right for that, and they have the right to expect that. And the individual needs really need to be addressed at that visit. And that's all I want to say. I just want to encourage you to consider our patients when you consider this bill. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning. My name's Elaine Dragomir, and I've been an RN since 1984. I've actually worked as a nurse's aide and then as an LPN since I was 14 years old. I've always been a nurse. For me, nursing is more than just a job. It's my passion, it's something I always dreamed of as a little girl and worked hard to get here. And so I'm standing here today as a member of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of this bill. For the past 6.5 years of my career, I have been a hospice nurse. And it's a great honor to provide care to people in the very end part of their life. It's something that I'm enjoying doing a lot more than I thought I would. A large percentage of hospice patients, I'd say maybe above 75%, want to be in their homes. Most of them want to die in their homes. They definitely all want to be in their homes as long as possible. It's where people are the most comfortable. And by bringing in my professional assessments, level of care, and probably the most important thing I bring is teaching. I'm teaching mostly family members to provide nursing care, essentially, to the patient.
and that makes it possible for them to remain in their homes. In the past 4 years, I've seen a decline in the amount of routine visits that are normally scheduled for our patients. When I first started, we saw patients, a nurse saw patients twice a week without fail. And now I see the more stable patients being scheduled a nursing visit every 2 weeks. Anyone who's on hospice care is very, very ill, and they're dying. According to their physician, they're dying, and they're going to die soon. And their conditions can change very rapidly, and they do. And the medically untrained caregivers that have just been shown by the nurses how to do the care don't catch the kind of subtle changes that occur that let us know that the person's moving forward in the dying process. And so they reach out only when crises begin to happen. And, you know, those crises can be many, many things. They can be the obvious ones. The patient's very painful. They can't breathe. They're very agitated. And these kind of things cause patients to need to go back to the hospital, go into nursing homes, die in places that they didn't choose. I also see a large degree of caregiver breakdown, which is just where caregivers become exhausted and overwhelmed, where if we were in there and catching it sooner, that very well might not have happened. And I guess, as I said earlier, most hospice patients don't want to die in a hospital. They want to die at home. And they certainly don't want to die in a nursing home. The concerns I have, and I'm going to try to limit them because some of them are the same as what Billy stated, but if this were to become the standard of how hospice care is delivered, obviously we would have a lot less time to teach people. And teaching is not something you can just go in with a plan and toss it at somebody. They have to be ready for it. Lots of times families in the very beginning don't want to hear about the care you're going to need to provide in the last few days of life. They don't want to think about that. In fact, sometimes they believe that it may not occur. It's certainly going to give me a whole lot less time if I'm not there with them to talk to family members and especially the patient about what's going to happen as you die. What's the process? What can you expect? People that know what to expect have a lot less anxiety and fear. And anxiety and fear are the number one things that cause people to have that caregiver breakdown, I think. And we also, as Billy said, there's not a big thought consideration taking in for what we're going to do with these hospice patients that have a higher level of care. And some people, you wouldn't believe that they could come home as sick. They look like they belong in an intensive care bed. And yet, with the proper amount of teaching and time that we spend, they're able to come home. And we've certainly touched on the driving time, but I want to tell you just briefly about a conversation I had last week with the nurse. She said to me, I drove 135 miles today. And on top of that, they were asking me if I wouldn't just see one more person. The person lived 50 miles from where she was at, would have meant that she went way over 200 miles in a day. Now, this nurse worked a 12-hour shift, but I mean, you can see where almost half her day would have been spent driving. Not only is that exhausting to do all that driving, but if it's not counted and taken into consideration, it just wouldn't work. And the last, well, not the last, but the second to the last thing I want to talk about is documentation. You know, because I've been in this profession a long time, the amount of time that it takes to document has increased. I'd say if I spend an hour with a patient that I expect to spend at least 20 minutes doing paperwork, and sometimes almost an hour, you know, because of additional things as phone calls and other people have talked about. And the last thing I just want to point out is that
I think if we went to this sort of system, that we would see increased nursing burnout. And I'm sure that people here have heard of nursing burnout, but it's when the nurse becomes exhausted and can't continue. Nurses don't want to give okay or mediocre care. We don't have like a level of care that we feel like is ho-hum that we want to give. We want to give excellent care. We want to give anybody in here that needs care the same care that we would give our mother, our father, or that we would want ourselves. And in doing this, we do often work more than an 8-hour day. It's not uncommon for a nurse to work a 10-hour day now. It's exhausting, but they're compensated for those last 2 hours, and it motivates the agency that they work for to monitor and make sure that their assignments are reasonable. If we had this sort of program in place, there would be no way that they would be motivated to make sure that that was, you know, that there was any fair way for people to have assignments. I don't want to support something that's going to cause more nurses to leave nursing. We have a shortage. I'm one of the baby boomers. Probably a couple other people in this room are. I want there to be a good, experienced hospice nurse to take care of me when I'm dying. And I want that for you, too, if that's what you want. And that won't be in place if our nurses leave their profession. And I'm just going to end by saying that this is truly way more than a form of reimbursement. Thank you very much.
You know, I could never do your job. I'm always looking at the clock, which is rude. But, you know, and I've worked like a dog my whole life, but I'm getting burned out just listening to what you guys, what you folks go through. I don't know how you do it. And when my dad died, I lived here. He lived 2,000 miles away, so our sister and my other brother managed that, and our mother. I'd imagine now my mother's out here, and I'm actually experiencing this myself. But you when you are there for the patient, are you allowed to administer medical care to the spouse or family member? I imagine there's certain situations where there may be two emergencies going on.
I have called ambulances before.
Yeah, I have too, yeah. And I take blood pressures on occasion. I think we all do that. But sure. Other than that, I think we couldn't really give them medication or anything.
Well, would anybody have questions of these wonderful people? Representative Thatcher.
I think it's a quick question, but if it's not, maybe just get back to me later.
Okay.
I've heard talk about quality versus quantity, and how is quality measured? I mean, it sounds like you're there by yourself. Do the folks at home, I imagine you're all great, but I imagine there could be some conflicts maybe with some family members that don't like you.
That happens.
And they might, yeah, and so what do they do? Do they know that there's some sort of a complaint process, so to speak?
Absolutely.
Okay.
For one thing, we're a member of a team. So each team has a nursing assistant, a social worker, a chaplain, sometimes a physician is actually seeing the patient in their home too. So, you know, you don't like me. My social worker, you say, I don't like Elaine. And, you know, she bothers me. She's too chatty. She's way too familiar. And then she comes to me and says, you know what, we have a problem here. And either we fix it or I don't see that patient anymore and I'm assigned somebody else.
Okay, thanks. I was just wondering about
just
that.
For the record, thank you. Representative Edwards was excused. And our colleagues, Representative Cameron and Representative Holvey, we have a lot going on here, and they had to excuse them as well. So, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that any one of us who have ever been through an instance where we need the services of these fine folks, we just know that you're angels. Thank you for what you do. And anything that that we can do to assist you with your patient care, which is paramount for the folks in your profession, I'm glad that you've brought this bill to us, and I think it's just one little thing that we can do to assist you professionally in probably the most humanistic endeavor that anybody could ever be engaged in, so thank you.
Thank you.
I think we all agree. on our gratitude for your willingness to do this work. Any further questions of these wonderful people today? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
Keep
you.
Up the good work. Anyone else in the last minutes like to testify to this bill today? And we will be getting all the information and amendments and everything back, and then we intend to work the bill and have votes on the committee. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing, House Bill 2595. Anything for good of the order? All right, we're adjourned.